Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Great Expectations by Vincent Cunningham. As much as I pretend that I'm too conscientious, too emancipated, too black, and mostly just too lazy to succumb to a cult, the aesthetic choices I made in 2008, when a distressed white tee featuring Shepard Fairey's rendering of Barack Obama was an essential part of my wardrobe, remind me I ain't that special. Still, I had company. Great Expectations, Vincent Cunningham's brolic and dazzlingly written debut novel, transports us to that time when America's most valuable commodity was proximity, real or perceived, burgeoning or dimming, to the soon-to-be president. Cunningham, a staff writer at The New Yorker, who worked in his 20s on the Obama campaign and in his White House, ferries us through a year in the orbit of an Obama-like figure known to us only as the senator, and then the candidate. And let's get this out of the way. Obama-like is a misnomer. This ain't an interpretation, like Jeff Bridges' Clinton-esque Jackson Evans from The Contender, or even the Clinton-adjacent Jed Bartlett on The West Wing. Dissimilarities between the fabricated candidate and the flesh-and-blood Obama are non-existent. And maybe fairies is the wrong word, too, because Great Expectations moves in 249 quick pages with propulsive energy, pausing the barnstorm to consume and deconstruct the sights along the way. David Hammond is brilliant but rudderless, a college dropout and single dad thrust into the candidate's circle thanks to the elusive, shrewd, and increasingly, as the book continues, sexy Beverly Whitlock, a benefactor slash rabbi slash whoever the hell she wants to be, with one of those nebulous finance gigs where you're never quite sure how they make all that money, but always dead certain they wouldn't hesitate to bury you with it. We are quickly introduced to staffers and canvassers, to fundraisers and their targets, to celebrity academics and scions of music moguls, all thirsty to be validated. Cunningham captures the grind and the mundanity of the campaign with precision and humor, and via the incorporation of staff-specific shorthand. Airplane rules, David repeats to a crowd waiting in line to pass through the Apollo Theater's metal detectors. A supervisor later reminds him to look at the audience's faces and not the candidates at speaking engagements, to better know which ones you could ask for a check. Cunningham answers myriad questions I've always had, but never asked, such as, where do young staffers sleep when stationed in new cities? Trailer parks, highway motels, anywhere with a cheap and friendly bed. And how often do they hook up? Define often. The latter happens to David during a short but sweet tryst with a fellow staffer in New Hampshire that generates a lucid exploration of the self-consciousness and messy neuroses some heterosexual men bring to sex. The only real skill that's portable from one person to the next is maybe openness, David's partner suggests to alleviate his anxiety about entering the bedroom without a rubric for guaranteed success. The book especially floats when Cunningham, who, like David, is black, explores the social lexicon of intra-racial hierarchy surrounding the candidate, well, not always surrounding, but wishing to surround him, are the sort of black people who use summer as a verb. The Martha's Vineyard blacks, the Hollywood with cocaine connections blacks, the big money Manhattan Cobb salad blacks, all grasping and paying for the candidate's attention, like a plover bird lurking around a crocodile's mouth, and most of them the product of generations of past brown paper bag tests. It's striking how none of these people even feign interest in the potential for America's spiritual transformation that the candidate's messaging promises. No, that performance of interest in piety was for white people, and I guess black people with t-shirts. Embedded throughout the novel is David's relationship to Christianity and, just as frequent, Christianity's relationship to him, often told through the epistle-like backstories of his family and his church, a counterbalance to the messianic draw of the candidate and the nakedly transactional soullessness of his wealthy flock. While I appreciated the texture of these hermeneutics each time Cunningham moved away from the urgent present of the campaign and David's close but amorphous connection with Beverly, it lost momentum. Also, with autofiction that incorporates so many obvious allusions to famous people, and some actual real people are named here too, why this instead of a memoir? It's a curiosity I had, but a mid-novel change in a central relationship solved it for me. Of course, a book entitled Great Expectations will draw comparisons between David Hammond and Dickens' Pip. Yes, coming-of-age stories are familiar. From Malcolm Little to Forrest Gump, American literature is filled with common young men who find themselves, through chance and serendipity, immersed in the slippery world of choice and privilege. Rarer is a debut that announces a talent like Cunningham's. This is a writer who clearly loves black people, but this affection is also a challenge, a charge to interrogate the social and spiritual cost of currency, and a reminder not to look at the candidate's face for answers. This review was written by Damon Young. He is a writer in residence at the University of Pittsburgh and the author of What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, a memoir in essays. Wild Houses by Colin Barrett. In Raymond Carver's short story, Why Don't You Dance?, a man whose wife has left him places the entirety of their home on his front lawn, arranged as it was on the inside, as an act of defiant despair. A young couple, referred to only as the boy and the girl, come along and presume the man is holding a yard sale. They barter for the haunted detritus of a failed marriage, and later the girl senses what the boy never does, that their life together may one day mirror that of the man and his unseen ex-wife. I thought often of that story while reading Colin Barrett's heartbreaker of a debut novel, Wild Houses, which is set over a single weekend in the small Irish town of Ballina in County Mayo. Crowds have arrived for the annual Salmon Festival, and 17-year-old Nikki Hennigan, who works as a waitress at the Pearl Hotel, is facing a gauntlet of shifts without a day off when her boyfriend, Dahl English, disappears. Dahl has been kidnapped by Gabe and Sketch Ferdia, two brothers of tired malice who have a seemingly limitless potential for gutter violence. The Ferdia brothers have brought Dahl, unannounced, to the home of Dev Hendrick, a somewhat gentle giant who lives in rural isolation with Georgie, a dog who mostly ignores him. Everyone seems to ignore Dev or take him for a simpleton, or, ironically, given his size, a weakling. As he becomes the unwitting host of a poorly planned ransom demand, he's given opportunity to reflect on a life lived less in quiet desperation than in desperate passivity, given to panic attacks that begin with a cold, almost ecstatic shiver along the nape of his neck and turn his throat into a shrinking keyhole. Dev might be the only hope Dahl has to walk out of the house alive. But how does a man somewhat addicted to inaction pick the correct moment to act? The Ferdia brothers have kidnapped Dahl because his brother, Killian, a feckless and failed drug dealer, owes them 18,000 euros after drugs he stashed on their behalf were destroyed in a natural calamity. Natural calamities of all shapes and sizes abound in Wild Houses. So does abandonment. Nikki was raised by a brother after her parents died when she was young. Dev's beloved mother has recently died, while his mentally ill father wanders about town, trying to press strangers into laying bets for him at the track. Dahl and Killian were long ago abandoned by their father and left in the care of their mother, Sheila, who has migraines caused by a sensitivity to light, too much light, direct light, light above a certain intensity. It could be argued that the heart and soul of Irish character were one to venture into generalities, stem from a sensitivity to light. Certainly, the characters in this novel see very little sun, both metaphorically and practically. Theirs is a gray existence. The houses are cramped, the streets narrow, the vast fields untilled. When Nikki, on her fervent odyssey to find Dahl, searches the quiet and empty countryside, she finds herself lost in orders of rural obscurity where the land was holding its tongue and steadfastly averting its gaze. Nikki and her quest is the soul of this fine novel. She is, like the girl in the Carver story, a creature fumbling and stumbling through her own self-awakening. She knows, with a quiet, somewhat tragic certainty, that she will outgrow this world of pubs and cigarettes and fatalism. She will leave all of it and the people she loves behind. In this way, she is a portrait of survivor's guilt before the guilt, or the surviving, has occurred. With Dev, the other pole of fractured decency in this inhospitable environment, Nikki shares an acute isolation buried deep in the body. She wanders as if the soul or alien divine, or whatever one calls the intangible essence of a human being, has no twin, no soulmate, no spiritual brethren. What waits for them when the noise or the music stops, when the last call is called, is the empty ticking of the self. All the characters in Wild Houses have this fear, even the Ferdia brothers, who meet it with the unreliability, but also the dangerous decisiveness of creatures who did not understand their natures and did not care to. In Colin Barrett's Nimble Hands, save for the occasional adverb so obtrusive and unnecessary it muddies what it's supposed to make clear, the lives of a small collective of mournful souls become vibrant before us, and their yearning is depicted with wistfulness, no small amount of humor, and one dangerously ill-tempered goat. This review was written by Dennis Lehane. He is the author of 12 novels. His latest is Small Mercies. James by Percival Everett. Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, the critic Lionel Trilling wrote, is one of the world's great books and one of the central documents of American culture, in part because it grows with its readers. Mark Twain's 1884 novel is a catapulting adventure story when one is 10, but its amplitude is grasped only in adulthood. Here is a question Trilling did not pick up. What about the 10-year-old black reader who wishes to be catapulted too, but is too young to understand that the novel's language, with its 219 uses of the N-word, derives from Twain's writerly fidelity to the vernacular speech of the American South in the 1830s or 1840s, when the novel is set? This has long been an implacable and racking issue. Paul Beatty, in his novel The Sellout, wrestled with this conundrum. One of his characters decides to read Huckleberry Finn aloud to his grandchildren. He does not get far. Then he gets an idea. Although they are the deepest thinking, combat-ready 8- and 10-year-olds, I know, I knew my babies weren't ready to comprehend Huckleberry Finn on its own merits. That's why I took the liberty to rewrite Mark Twain's masterpiece. Where the repugnant N-word occurs, I replaced it with warrior, and the word slave with dark-skinned volunteer. Percival Everett's majestic new novel, James, goes several steps further. Everett flips the perspective on the events in Huckleberry Finn. He gives us the story as a coolly electric first-person narrative in the voice of Jim, the novel's enslaved runaway. The pair's adventures on the raft as it twisted down the Mississippi River were largely, from Huck's perspective, larks. From James's, point of view, nearly every second is deadly serious. We recall that Jim told Huck in Twain's novel that he was quite done with adventures. Everett's James is indeed a warrior of a humane, frazzled, and reluctant sort. By the time this novel is finished, he will have killed men and freed fellow slaves and set fire to a particularly dismal plantation. He will be whispered about, a legend. What's more, Everett has rendered him an ambitious reader, one who instantly grasps, for example, that the Bible is a tool of his oppressors, and who has extended internal dialogues with Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Voltaire, and John Locke, sometimes about slavery. James is literate, and he is taking notes. These notes are costly. Another slave who pilfers a pencil stub for him is lynched for the act. Because this is a Percival Everett novel, we are not surprised that he tears down and rebuilds a cultural landmark. In addition to his publishing industry satire, Erasure, which became the Cord Jefferson film American Fiction, this prolific writer has issued novels that take on the complicated legacies of historical figures. These include Sidney Poitier in I Am Not Sidney Poitier, which is one of the funniest novels I have ever read, and the prune-faced South Carolina segregationist Strom Thurmond in A History of the African American People, proposed by Strom Thurmond as told to Percival Everett and James Kincaid. Because this is a Percival Everett novel, too, it luxuriates in language. Everett, like Twain, is a master of American argot. He is the code switcher's code switcher. In James, he puts his skills to incandescent use. His narrator runs his every public utterance through what he calls his slave filter to make himself sound ridiculous and gullible, to pacify the truculent white people around him. Here is that practice in action, as James explains to a group of enslaved children in a cabin, including a girl named February, how to survive. The children said together, and the better they feel, the safer we are. February, translate that. Damo better they feels, damo safer we be. Nice. And here is James finding himself in Judge Thatcher's library. I had wondered every time I sneaked in there what white people would do to a slave who had learned how to read. What would they do to a slave who had taught the other slaves to read? What would they do to a slave who knew what a hypotenuse was, what irony meant, how retribution was spelled? What sets James above Everett's previous novels, as casually and caustically funny as many are, is that here the humanity is turned up, way up. This is Everett's most thrilling novel, but also his most soulful. Beneath the wordplay and below the packed dirt floor of Everett's moral sensibility, James is an intensely imagined human being. Ta-Nehisi Coates, in Between the World and Me, wrote that slavery is not an indefinable mass of flesh, but a particular, specific enslaved woman whose mind is active as your own, whose range of feeling is as vast as your own. Everett more than lives up to that prescription. He is not scoring easy points. He is evoking and critiquing the American experiment, circa the middle of the 19th century, from a wised-up slave's point of view. Huck talked a lot about feeling lonesome in Twain's novel. Everett's James, at certain moments, seems like the loneliest man who ever lived. Everett mostly sticks to the broad outlines of Twain's novel. He is riding the same currents. The book flows inexorably like a river, yet its short chapters keep the movement swift. James is on the run, of course, because he has learned that Miss Watson plans to sell him to a man in New Orleans. He will be separated from his wife and children. Huck is on the run because he has faked his own death after being beaten by his father. They find each other on an island in the Mississippi, and their flight begins. The reader slowly discovers that their bonds run deeper than friendship. There are familiar large scenes, like Huck and James's separation in a fog, and their encounter with the deadly con artists, the Duke and the King. But smaller moments are reproduced as well, such as James's suffering after a rattlesnake bite and Huck's need to dress like a girl to disguise his identity. Other scenes drop out, and Everett shifts the setting forward 2 decades or so, so that we glimpse Union soldiers marching south. New scenes are inserted. I will mention only one because it is so extraordinary and so deft. At one point, James is bought by the Virginia Minstrels, a blackface singing troupe. They really existed. Twain was a fan. They need a new tenor, and they've heard him singing for his brutal new owner. Because no black man can appear on a stage, James must himself put on blackface. The moment is ludicrous and terrifying. The troupe includes 10 white men in blackface, 1 black man passing for white and painted black, and me, a light brown black man, painted black in such a way as to appear like a white man trying to pass for black. In these scenes, Everett makes potent use of the era's songbook. He also delivers this unforgettable moment when James, in disguise, is allowed for the first time to stare into the eyes of his oppressors. White people came out and lined the street, smiling and laughing and clapping. I made eye contact with a couple of people in the crowd, and the way they looked at me was different from any contact I had ever had with white people. They were open to me, but what I saw looking into them was hardly impressive. They sought to share this moment of mocking me, mocking darkies, laughing at the poor slaves with joyful, spirited clapping and stomping. My idea of hell would be to live with a library that contained only reimaginings of famous novels. It's a wet-brained and dutiful genre, by and large. Or the results are brittle spoofs, to use a word that, according to John Barth, sounds like imperfectly suppressed flatulence, that read as if there are giant scare quotes surrounding the action. Two writers in 100 walk away unscathed. James is the rarest of exceptions. It should come bundled with Twain's novel. It is a tangled and subversive homage, a labor of rough love. His humor and humanity affected me long before I became a writer, Everett writes of Twain in his acknowledgments. Heaven for the climate, hell for my long-awaited lunch with Mark Twain. Everett does not reprint the famous warning that greets the reader at the start of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Persons attempting to find a motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral in it will be banished. Persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot. Motives, morals, and plot are here in abundance, of course, and Everett shoots what is certain to be this book's legion of readers straight through the heart. This book review was written by Dwight Garner. He has been a book critic for The Times since 2008, and before that was an editor at The Book Review for a decade. The Split by Kit Frick. In Kit Frick's The Split, Jane Connor gets a call one night from her needy younger sister, Esme. She's left her husband and wants Jane to drive from suburban Connecticut to New York City to pick her up, even though a storm is raging. Still burdened by guilt after nearly killing Esme in a drunken car crash years earlier, Jane hesitates. Should she stay or should she go? This is where the story divides in two, with a sliding doors-style sleight of hand. Half the chapters, marked Gone, play out a scenario in which Jane waits until morning to travel to the city, only to find that Esme has vanished. In the other half, marked Home, Jane retrieves Esme that night and brings her to Connecticut, which leads to unexpected complications. I suppose all lives have such pivotal moments, paths diverging, cracking in two, Jane muses, though the finality of the split registers only when we take stock of the universe we now inhabit, surrender to the swift death of the other. She's speaking about her mother's move from the family house to a nursing home, but you get the point. In each scenario, Frick slowly ratchets up the suspense, introducing supporting characters whose relevance takes time to unfold. The girl's mother, who's suffering from dementia, their estranged father, and two boyfriends and a husband who may or may not be up to something creepy. The biggest secrets, it turns out, lie far back into the sisters' tangled histories. Are our destinies written in our pasts? I'm not sure Frick adheres fully to the rigorous logic of sliding doors, in which each decision leads inexorably to the next event, but it's great fun to watch her two narratives collide and diverge. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.